Good morning. My name is Erin Radican. I'm an attorney for the appellant, Sixto Padilla-Gomez. If it please the court, I'm going to ask to reserve 2 minutes for my rebuttal.
So that means after 8 minutes, you're taking 10 and your co-counsel's taking 10?
That's correct.
You may. Go ahead.
The first issue I would like to discuss is the government has filed a 28J letter citing Florida versus Harris. I don't believe that this case is relevant at all to the dog sniff discovery violation issue. The court in that case held that training and testing records were sufficient to establish reliability for probable cause purposes and specifically noted that the probable cause standard is flexible and a commonsensical standard, and also spoke about how deficiencies in evidence in some areas can make up for a lack of reliability in the training and certification records. So I don't feel that that's relevant to the discovery issue. With regard to the discovery issue, I don't believe the government disputes that discovery indicating that the truck in Garcia Valdez's driveway belonged to Mr. Padilla-Gomez was discovered to the defense. This was not something that the defense was aware of until the first day of trial.
So you had discovery regarding the truck itself, but prior to the government's opening statement, you didn't realize that they had linked it to Padilla-Gomez? Is that what the evidence reflects?
That's correct, Your Honor. The evidence shows that there was a black truck parked in the driveway. There's no make, model, license plate information or any link to Mr. Padilla-Gomez. The government argues that Mr. Padilla-Gomez should have realized it was his truck and should have informed his attorney and should have informed the government.
Didn't you voir dire on dog sniff evidence and the handler?
Yes, Your Honor. There was an opportunity to voir dire. However, the handler, Agent Updegraff, testified that it was his subjective assessment that dog sniff evidence that his dog was 90% reliable, and he admitted in his testimony that he was not able to give any kind of assessment on the percentage of false positives that Trapper...
Doesn't that just go to the weight, not to the admissibility? It's sort of like I could come into court and I could say, well, I'm 90% sure that's the guy that assaulted me, but I'm not 100% sure. That doesn't mean I can't testify to it, but then the defense would get up and say, well, the prosecutor has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and 90% sure isn't good enough.
I disagree, Your Honor. There's minimum standards of reliability, as you know, under Daubert and under Federal Rules of Evidence 702. And if the defense had a time to do a motion to exclude, the defense would have had the opportunity to hire an expert. The jury could, especially in this case, the jury would have been assisted by having evidence of studies on how often dogs have false positives. And given the deficiency in Updegraff's testimony, that would have been useful to the jury. Almost the sole evidence that the government had to say that Mr. Padilla-Gomez delivered a portion of marijuana to the buy was this dog sniff evidence, and the government used it as if it was substantive evidence, so it was very prejudicial, and we have the agent testifying that it's 90% reliable.
So you're saying this almost the sole evidence was the dog sniff regarding your client?
Almost the sole evidence to say that he was a part that brought a portion of the marijuana to the deal. The only other evidence was communications between Garcia Valdez and the agents indicating that some of the marijuana would be brought up. There wasn't any indication of who was going to bring it up, just that it was coming up down south, from down south.
Was your client there when the big bus went down?
Yes.
Okay, so is that any evidence against him?
That's evidence. The government had two theories. The government had a theory that he was a lookout, and the government had the theory that he brought up a portion of the marijuana to the deal. And those are different roles.
But are they different charges?
They are not different charges. However, with regard to the lookout theory, there was much weaker evidence. If the evidence of the bringing a portion of the marijuana to the deal hadn't been there and he hadn't been connected to bringing some of the marijuana up, you would just have a very similar situation to the Penagos case, for example, where you have someone who's alleged to be a lookout, but he's just there during the deal. Your Honor, I would like to move, since I have limited time, to the insufficient evidence on the gun issue.
Okay, now is your client the one who they that the prior evidence was admitted on?
Yes.
Okay, and so that relates to in that particular incident, there was a weapon involved too, correct?
There was a weapon involved, but the district court made a very serious error here, and the error the district court made in admitting that evidence is holding that because my client admitted a vicarious arming enhancement in his state case, that he necessarily knew the gun was there. The vicarious arming enhancement under California law does not require knowledge of a weapon, and there was no evidence that Mr. Padilla Gomez was ever at the staging area, no evidence that he knew a firearm was available. He brought supplies to the cultivation site.
Did the jury hear the fact that in the prior conviction there was a gun found? Because this relates to the Pinkerton foreseeability with regard to your client.
Yes, the jury did hear that there was a gun in the staging area. And I argued that the prior shouldn't be admitted for that purpose, that it was very prejudicial because there was no evidence that my client knew that the gun was in the staging area in the primary case, the first case. But the district court seemed to, my understanding was, didn't really seem to get that admitting the vicarious arming enhancement did not mean that he admitted that he had knowledge of a gun, because there's no knowledge element.
Okay, so he didn't have knowledge in the prior case, and he didn't. And his theory was he didn't have knowledge in this case, and it was admitted under, because it was a Pinkerton theory of the foreseeability. So I can see why you would say it was prejudicial, because it certain. But the type of prejudicial that you're talking about isn't exactly the same as it's bad for your client. It was clearly probative. So the prejudicial that you have to be talking about is somehow that the facts in that case were, you know, highly incendiary, not that they tended to show his guilt. So how was it, what was the, how do you argue prejudice under the way this, the language prejudice means, not bad for your client?
What I mean, Your Honor, is that the probative value was so low because there was no evidence that he was aware a firearm was present in the prior case, that the prejudicial value of the likelihood that the jury would use that as pure propensity
but
evidence.
But didn't he claim he didn't know that he wasn't aware of it in the present case, too?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So doesn't that kind of make it relevant? I mean, if he keeps claiming the same thing, I'm never aware, but I'm always in cars with guns?
Your Honor, the first case was a very different kind of case. He wasn't near the staging area. He delivered supplies, not even down near the staging area. In this case, he is in a car in the front seat as a passenger, and the gun is tucked in the side compartment. The government doesn't dispute that he wasn't aware of the gun.
Which
it's a
gun?
Pure
the .38 or the Magnum?
I'm running out. I'm getting close to my 2 minutes. Let me just finish that. The gun that was in...
Counsel, don't mumble into the mic. If you get asked a question, just answer the question. Don't worry about the time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm talking about the gun in the present instant offense. It was in...
Yes, there's a .38 and then there's a .457 Magnum or a .357 Magnum. Are you talking of... Which gun are you talking about?
I'm sorry. Respectfully, I forgot which is which. I'm talking about the gun in the brown... a truck that my client was the passenger of. There was a gun in the rear that was in a camera case tucked into a compartment in the rear. I don't think the government disputes that he didn't know that gun was there. It's a pure Pinkerton theory, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Art Crowley, and I represent Mr. Herrera Orsonio. I want to speak to a couple of the sentencing issues. Initially, I want to point out that one of the issues is that the jury here, in reaching their verdict, convicted the defendants of growing only 1,000 plants. any plants that were taken into consideration after that where we submit not counted. There's a statement that it's based on the 4,000 amount is based on an estimate by Agent Salzberg, and clearly an estimate is not good enough. It then states that there are 19 other...
So what would have been good enough, to count every plant?
Pardon me?
Would counting every plant...
Well, if they'd apparently using at least the same system that they did in by the two officers, Markey and Rice, who did, in fact, count and got and counted 2,000 of the plants. There at least should be some identification of what officers counted and where they counted it.
Didn't they present something to the effect of that, okay, they counted the 2,000, and then they said, I don't know, there's three per a certain amount of, and then they could see that, you know, I mean, there were clearly more than the 2,000. So it wasn't exact, but
right.
Does it have to be exact?
Well, it should be closer than it is, because it ends up being an enhancement in the sentencing process. In fact, that's the main problem I think there is in this situation, and that is that the witnesses having to do with now with the my next issue and main issue, which is that.
Well, by your calculation, how many marijuana plants were there? More than 1,000?
Correct. I would concede that there were 2,000.
All right. Well, the district court sentenced your client to the mandatory minimum. So does it matter?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. That's something that's been argued continually, and it does matter, because there's under Rule 35, it's possible to reduce a sentence after a person has been sentenced. Originally, when it was brought in, it was for a period of 1 year. Now it's extended to longer periods, depending upon certain circumstances. So there's no telling in this particular situation whether that's something that might arise. And so therefore, the specifics and closeness and correctness of the estimates, and not estimates, but the counting and every other consideration is extremely important, because, in fact, if that situation came about, which comes about frequently enough that they enlarge the period of time.
Well, okay, so has there been anything that came up in the year after he was sentenced that would have allowed him to get relief from the mandatory minimum?
No, not at this point.
Okay, so why isn't it harmless here then?
Well, it's also used for purposes by the Bureau of Prisons in terms of designation and in terms of programs, and I can't give you specifically what all of them are at this point, but there certainly can be some that can relate to the seriousness and the degree of the crime and the degree of the particular defendant's involvement.
But again, in the volume, or he got mandatory minimum, so how would Bureau of Prisons, you're saying they'll look to the amount of drugs involved?
Well, I'm not necessarily that particular thing, but I'm actually also talking generally in terms of what should be allowed and what shouldn't be allowed under the circumstances. If I could move on to what I think is the essence of this thing that relates to this.
I mean, on the sentencing, I can see why it would matter if the mandatory minimum is triggered by the number of plants and it makes a difference. But here, given that there's no dispute, it's at least 1,000 plants, he would have gotten the same sentence anyway. So you're appealing that issue based on the theoretical possibility that he could somehow earn a sentence reduction. Is that right?
There was also error in finding him to be a supervisor, because that was based on that he was supervising the two juveniles, which originally were thought to be relatives of his cousins, and that turned out to not be the case. The government argues that the supervisory role can turn primarily on cooperator statements, and also states that the district court found that the cooperator statements are what are essential in the findings in this area. And the problem with that is that means that the cooperating witnesses who are responsible for providing the information to make these determinations were not in the trial, did not appear at the trial, and therefore all the protections against informant testimony, including the jury instruction that specifically addresses it, were eliminated. And what happened is that the statements were brought in, I would say, through the back door, because they were just made outside of court, either to the agent or to the U.S. attorney, and then probably passed on to the probation officer, who includes them in the report. And that's it's the pre-sentence report that these considerations were based on. And that opens a very wide door in a slippery slide, because there's concern nationally about informants in trials and credibility. And we now have a situation where trial courts are working on trying to correct some of that. And now we have a situation where we're just eliminating that. And if the cooperating witnesses don't appear at all, they can come in the back door through the probation process at a much lesser.
So remind me, in this case, how did that work?
Pardon me?
Remind me specifically what you're complaining about in this case.
I think to allow it in this case passes on to other situations, and it's an overall problem that I'm addressing that I believe this case demonstrates.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Beckwith on behalf of the United States. May it please the Court, I was trial counsel in this case.
Mr. Beckwith, both the defendants make challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence in the case, which then means we have to read everything. And the weakest appears to me to be regarding the foreseeability of bringing the gun to the buy bust. Could you please, because you get all inferences in favor of the verdict, and it was argued on a Pinkerton theory, correct? Can you tell me all the evidence on that relative to each defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. To begin with, on September 4th of 2008, the defendants in this case were involved in a huge narcotics deal worth of roughly $500,000 that involved 300 pounds of marijuana, at least 8 different defendants, 2 buyers, 4 different vehicles. The size, the scope, the value of this deal says something about the likelihood that firearms would be used or be a part of this deal. We also had testimony from Detective Stevenson saying that as the deal increased in size or in value, foreseeability also.
So this was
increased.
As an expert, the agent was allowed to testify?
Yes, Your Honor.
As to when there's more dope, more likelihood of a gun?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so that's part of it.
With regard to Padilla Gomez specifically, he also has the prior conviction that we've been talking about, the 404B evidence. He was involved in another marijuana conspiracy. Obviously, the goal of any manufacturing conspiracy is to sell the marijuana. Here we have a sale of $500,000 worth of marijuana, roughly.
If we said that shouldn't have come in, then does that affect the sufficiency of the evidence argument against him?
No, Your Honor. There's more. What we have there is also his presence.
Well, it would affect it because we'd pull out, essentially, a chunk, right?
Certainly. It would limit our evidence, and we wouldn't be able to argue that. But I think even without the 404B evidence, the government has sufficient evidence to convict him on a Pinkerton theory. First of all, he's at 3 key locations on the key day of a deal that's taken 2 weeks to set up. He shows up at the AM PM in the morning when all the parties are meeting. He shows up at the Westbrook residence where we believe the marijuana was transferred from his vehicle to the ultimate load vehicle. And then finally, I think roughly 50 miles away, he shows up right at the right time at the right location on the scene of the buy bust.
That was when he's claiming he's going to Safeway, right?
Right. And, of course, to point out that is an important point there is that the parking lot that day was almost empty. They parked in the north side of the parking lot, three-quarters, I guess, most of the distance away from the Safeway. So they had to walk all the way across an empty parking lot to get to the Safeway. That theory was discussed by the agents during direct, and all of them indicated that these people were engaged in counter-surveillance, acting as lookouts.
Well, it seemed odd that the guns were not loaded.
Yes,
you know,
I understand.
I mean, that's like bringing a knife to a gunfight, or, you know, why are you bringing a gun if you don't load it? You know, that's... So does it have to be loaded as an element of the crime?
It does not, no.
Okay, but it was, at least on the 38 caliber, as I understand, it was not only unloaded, it was in a camera case, and it was stowed away in the truck, and these defendants were never proximate to the truck. I mean, relatively speaking, they weren't anywhere near the truck. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor. Both of these defendants were in that truck. They came to the deal early to scout the location. Once the truck parked, they got out of the vehicle and walked south through the parking lot. We had testimony from Detective Davidson that indicated the .38 that was found in that vehicle was easily concealable. It had no hammer on it, so it could be put into a pocket pretty easily. Our position is that the weapon came out of that vehicle, went south in the parking lot with one of the defendants there, and then went back to the vehicle as soon as the buy bus went down. We believe that it was stored as soon as the police came. We believe that the defendants made an effort to store it and hide it. So that's why we find it in that position.
So both of these defendants were in the truck that had the .38 in it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the Magnum?
That was in a white Chevy that was on the other side of the parking lot. We have two kind of key locations in this parking lot. One is on the east side where the deal itself is going down. You have the load vehicle. You have the white Chevy that the leader was kind of that he arrived in, and you have the agents and their vehicle. On the other side of the parking lot, you have this brown Chevy where we think essentially their security team was based.
All right. So that's what you're relying for on in furtherance of the conspiracy?
It is. The fact that he's at three key locations that are miles apart on the right day. This deal took 2 weeks to put together, and we have evidence that Mr. Garcia Valdez, the organizer of this deal, was expecting the majority of the marijuana to be coming from a location down south, and that on the key day, at the key time, Mr. Padilla Gomez shows up at the AM-PM station and meets with Garcia Valdez there. So we think that Mr. Padilla Gomez brought the majority of the marijuana from...
Well, I'm thinking about the guns, though. The guns have to be in furtherance of the conspiracy, and they have to be foreseeable, right?
Yes, Your Honor, of course.
Okay, so these folks are being linked by circumstantial evidence. So the fact they're being proximate is... That's how you're proving that this is associated with this drug deal.
That's one piece of the evidence, their proximity to the deal. The other is, of course, we have the testimony of Detective Stevenson indicating that as the deal increases in size, the likelihood that guns would find their way into
that. That goes to foreseability.
Yes, sir.
Well, and also, there's evidence of ammo at what location?
Well, there's ammunition was found at the Westbrook residence. There was no ammunition found in the vehicles, and ammunition was also found at the Grow site, and that ammunition matched the weapons that were found in the deal. With regard to
the weapon in the brown truck, I don't know if that's the .38 or the other firearm.
It's a .38.
Now, did I understand you correctly that the government's theory in this case is that one of the two defendants had the gun in his pocket when he walked away from the truck across the parking lot?
It is.
And you're basing that based on the size of the gun, the fact that it is easily concealed, or not on any other particular piece of evidence, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and the fact that we're talking about a huge deal here. We're talking about $500,000 drug deal. And to leave the gun, I think it's a fair inference, which we're allowed and which we get, is that they would take the gun with them when they're operating.
Because if their roles were as lookouts and they walk away from the gun and it's not easily accessible, that would detract from the government's argument that there's foreseeability here.
Yes, and that's why we believe the gun was with them.
And was that inference argued to the jury?
It was.
So is it that you think that the defendants neglected to raise the jury instruction that it can still go against them even if it's not loaded? Or so was your argument that it probably was loaded and that they dumped the ammo, or what was?
No, our argument is that these are tools of intimidation, Your Honor. These weapons were ready and available, if need be, for the defendants to use. They can be used in a number of ways. They could have been flashed. They could have been mentioned. If the deal had, if the negotiations, the final last-minute negotiations, had gone awry, if someone had showed up with less money or didn't want to pay as much money, simply mentioning that firearm without even showing it can support a 924 conviction.
Well, so these were officers that were going to make that made the buy, or that, you know, that set all of this up. So were they searched for weapons before they met with the? I mean, do the.
There was nothing so formal as the defendants searching the officers for weapons. That did not happen, no. But we believe these weapons could have been used to facilitate the crime, as we talked about, as tools of intimidation, either by simply flashing the weapon, that can have an influence on someone, by brandishing the weapon. And in any of those instances, if it's mentioned, brandished, or flashed, you can't tell if it's loaded. So it still can be an effective tool of intimidation. It still can further the deal in this case. And so we...
The only evidence of the unloaded guns being flashed is your supposition that somebody put it in his on his person, because if it's tucked away in the truck and they're away from the truck, they're not going to flash it to anybody.
No, that's right.
And
if it was left in the truck, that's correct. If it was left in the truck. But we believe it was not left in the truck, and we believe it makes more sense. The reasonable inference that we think could be drawn by the jury is that the weapon was taken with the counter-surveillance team as it went away from the truck. And remember, we also have another weapon. We have the 357 in the white vehicle, which is closer to the deal itself. Either weapon can be used, yeah. And either weapon
no,
can
I'm
support.
I'm focused on the 38 because, as you were saying, could you address the 2005 conviction, the admission, I mean, not the conviction, but, well, the prior crime, because... As Judge Callahan pointed out, whether it's expresses harmful to the defendant, whatever, it's clearly a prejudicial piece of information to come before the jury. So what was the relevance of it?
Your Honor, this goes to the defendant's knowledge and to his intent. One of the defense here was mere presence. And so we have, you know, the government has an issue or has to address that defense. And
it has to be active.
Pinkerton
then.
Doesn't really require knowledge, right?
No, the touchstone with Pinkerton is foreseeability, Your Honor. It doesn't require any knowledge. Just is it foreseeable and were the weapons used in furtherance of the crime or in furtherance?
And this was introduced only on the guns, or it was introduced on his participation in the conspiracy?
Your Honor, I believe it was introduced. I'd have to think about that. I haven't looked at that issue recently, but my belief and my recollection of the trial was that it was introduced on, I think it was introduced on the guns, but it could have been introduced on both.
The judge gave, a limiting exactly. instruction.
Yes, Your Honor, there were two limiting instructions during trial. But it could go to both, Your Honor, because we have, when it comes to his knowledge, we have him at the Westbrook address in the morning. And the claim is that he was at the Westbrook residence and had no knowledge that 300 pounds of marijuana was being transferred from vehicle to vehicle. He had no knowledge that a large amount of marijuana was there. And the 2005 prior would say something about his ability to recognize the smell of marijuana, recognize the trappings. Well,
that sounds like more being involved in the transaction, not the guns.
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, I do think it was used for both, and I just haven't looked at that issue specifically in some time.
All right.
I would think it had to have been used for both because the defendant is vigorously disputing his knowledge regarding the presence of the gun on that prior occasion. So the safer course, if the government did need that, would have been not to ask that the gun regarding the prior be admitted. Under 404B.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. As we're discussing this now, it's coming, it's, you know, it comes back a little bit. Judge Nguyen, to address one of the questions you asked the defense, with regard to the dog sniff evidence, there were two documents and a video that the defendant had a year before trial. One was a surveillance report at the AM/PM station, which specifically identified the defendant's vehicle by license plate and by the defendant's name. They also had the search report, which said that a particular black truck that was backed into a driveway at a particular residence was searched by a dog. And then they had a video that shows the defendant, Padilla Gomez, right next to the black truck on the morning of September 4th. And so there was plenty, they had everything they needed to make the motion. But the real issue here, the way that I think the issue should be framed, is whether or not the judge erred in admitting that evidence. The abuse of discretion standard is applied to the judge's admission of that.
Will you concede that you were late in, you conceded some violation, right?
We do.
All right.
We were late in discovery under Cadano.
Okay.
On the dog, the evidence regarding the dog.
So, yes, some of the evidence. What we're talking about with the dog discovery, the four pages, there are four pages that we were late on, and that
was a 16A1G violation? Is that what you're conceding?
No, G is an expert violation. We're talking E and F, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so we don't think the dogs are, we don't think there's an expert issue here. We think it was a standard disclosure issue under E and F. And the four pages that came over later were given to the defense in time for them to use it a day before cross-examination.
But in terms of linkage, the defense wasn't taken by surprise, because by the time the government began jury selection, or the parties began jury selection, they already knew that the truck was linked to the defendant by his license plate in the police report and by the photo of him standing next to the truck.
That's correct. And they had that a year ahead of time, Your Honor. Judge Fischer, to address an issue that you raised with regard to the plant count, there were two agents that testified. Each of them individually counted 1,100 plants. And then there were other agents that we just didn't call, because we're now doubling the threshold for 1,000 plants. We just didn't call them. We submitted a report during sentencing that detailed specifically how many plants were counted by each agent. So it wasn't an estimation. There was an officer that made an estimation on the scene. But ultimately, when it went before the district judge, there was a precise number of over 4,200 plants that was detailed in an officer's report.
Okay. I'm not sure I raised the question, but I'm glad for the information. But could you address counsel's argument that the even though they got the mandatory minimum, there's still prejudicial effect because of the Rule 35 option and whatever may go on in the Bureau of Prisons?
Your Honor, there is no. The mandatory minimum is the lowest sentence the defendant could have received. We don't agree with the defendant's position on that. In fact, a sentence below 180 months, given the state of the law, would have been error.
I understand, but his point is that regardless, his post-imposition, at least I think I understood it, maybe I didn't, was that under Rule 35 there's an opportunity, once the sentence is imposed, to modify it or ameliorate it some way that will have beneficial effect to the defendant.
You can do that under Rule 35, Your Honor, if the defendant cooperates with the government. There's been no offer of cooperation. There's been no proffer. And so there's no reason or basis to depart below the guidelines.
All right.
Judge Callahan, earlier you'd asked the defense about a voir dire issue with regard to the dog. The main issue is admissibility here with regard to all the dog evidence. And the touchstone
is there any case that says that they have to have a Daubert hearing on dogs?
I could not find one, Your Honor. I looked. The closest thing we found was Cadano, and it doesn't really address the issue. It just talks about dog discovery in the context of standard discovery, not expert discovery. And so our position is the dog handler or the dog is not an expert, didn't require expert disclosure. And the only issue really is did the judge err in admitting that evidence? And that turns on the reliability of the dog. And so here we had an extensive voir dire that the defense engaged in, touching on every aspect of the dog's training, touching on its relationship with its handler and a number of other areas. And so we do believe that the district court had a sound basis to admit the evidence. And then, as you said earlier, the rest of it goes to the weight. I think the handler admitted that sometimes dogs are wrong, and so the jury had that.
Well, where the dog was sniffing, there wasn't any marijuana, right?
That's correct.
And then there was also some agent testimony that of smelling marijuana or smelling deodorizers that are consistent. But some of it wasn't written in a report. It just came up at the time of the hearing.
I believe the comment about deodorizers in the front was in the report. But Detective Stevenson indicated that he smelled marijuana at trial at the back of the truck. And so even if this dog issue were of interest to the court, we would argue that it's non-prejudicial, because you have a more specific set of testimony coming from Detective Stevenson. The dog only smells narcotics in general, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine. The agent said, "I specifically smelled marijuana." And so the admission of that evidence, even if it was an error, would not be prejudicial because you haven't.
Was the officer cross-examined on smelling the marijuana and whether he wrote it in a report or any of those things?
I believe the standard cross-examination was engaged in, and so he was crossed on that.
Okay.
Your Honor, unless you have further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
I think we're fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would note, too, that Mr. Pirelli indicated that
Come up to the mic. We can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Mr. Pirelli indicated that I could have the remainder of his time
as well. Go ahead.
A couple things I wanted to add. To make clear with regard to the discovery that we originally got before trial, there were two locations in discovery. One talked about the black truck at the AMPM that morning and that there was license plate and make and model information there. There's another place in discovery where it says there's a dark truck in the driveway that the dog alerted to. The video the government's talking about is this dark video where the defendant's out in the street. So the government's contention is that the defense should have been aware that that truck or defendant should have alerted counsel and that that would alleviate the government from their discovery obligation. So I just want to make clear that before trial, there wasn't the connection made between Mr. Padilla Gomez and the truck.
Well, you didn't make the connection, is what you're saying, right?
I didn't make the connection. My client didn't tell me the connection. I didn't know that a truck was his. And I think it's important that...
But you had the license plate. The report did identify the license plate, correct?
Of a different truck at a different location. There was nothing to tell me that the truck at the AMPM was the truck in the driveway. I didn't even have the make of the truck. There was no way for me to know that was a truck unless my client decided to tell me, and then I decided to tell the government, attorney-client privileged information, hey, I need dog sniff evidence, expert dog sniff evidence. I did ask for expert opinion evidence. And I think it's clear that a handler's testimony is expert evidence. And there are, I cited
cases. Well, if it's clear, do you have any case on the point?
I do, and I cited them in my reply brief, Your Honor.
On a dog sniff?
Yes.
Dauber?
Yes. I cited cases where the district court held that it was expert handler testimony. Testimony about a handler interpreting a dog sniff is expert opinion testimony. They're in my brief, Your Honor.
Okay. I guess that's a little bit of a different question that if... Do you have any cases where it mentions that you have to have a Daubert hearing on this?
No, I'm sorry, not a Daubert hearing.
Okay.
Just that it's expert opinion testimony, Your Honor. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is with regard to count three, there, as your questions make clear, there was no evidence whatsoever that the gun was on Mr. Padilla Gomez's person when he got out of the truck at all. The cop came up right as they were getting in the truck. I don't see how they would possibly have time to stow the gun back in the back seat. There was zero evidence on that. I don't think that's a fair inference from the evidence.
Well, I guess I think maybe the argument would be if you don't think it's a reasonable inference, there's no direct evidence that no one saw him with the gun on his person, correct? But I mean, circumstantial and direct evidence are both evidence and... So I guess the question is that a fair inference? You say it's not, and you say it is.
Yes, I don't think it's a fair inference when they're observed getting out of the truck and they walk up to the Safeway, and right before they get back in the truck, before they even get in the truck, the officer arrests them. I don't see how they'd have time to get the gun. With regard to the count three, I don't see a relevant difference between the Rios case and the Mann case here.
So did you argue those things in your closing argument? Did you do the closing argument?
I did, and I argued those things.
All right, and the jury went for the prosecution side and not for yours, right?
Yes.
Okay.
With regard to the gun, I think... And the district court said this was a close case on the Rule 29, and I think your questions make it clear. I don't see a relevant difference between the Mann case and the Rios case in this case. In this case, the gun is not accessible to my client. The government virtually concedes there's no evidence that he knew it was there. It's in a camera case, in a pocket, in the back seat, tucked in the side. No evidence that he knew it was there. Really, the only evidence they have is that this is a drug buy and that he should have inferred from a large drug buy that
they had testimony from the agent that not only is there a pretty close connection between drugs and guns, but this was a $500,000 deal.
Right. So that's presuming that Mr. Padilla-Gomez knew it was a $500,000 deal. And furthermore, you would think the inference would be that you would have a loaded gun and that you would have the gun on your person in order to use it as an object of intimidation. But we don't have any evidence that the gun was around to be used as an object of intimidation, or that it would be helpful at all in a robbery, because there was no ammunition anywhere on scene. So that, I think, detracts a great deal from that inference.
Okay, you've used up your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you both, all three of you, and we appreciate the argument. The case is submitted.